Hi, this is Colin Miller, one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast, filling in this week for John Cryer as the host of the Addendum episode on episode 2 of the Dennis Perry series. I'm joined today by two guests. First, we have Robin Warder. He lives in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, and is the host and writer of the Trail Went Cold podcast, which has been around for 2.5 years. He has a degree in scriptwriting and has previously published over 100 articles for websites such as Cracked and Listverse, many of which have covered true crime. On The Trail Went Cold, every episode delves into a different unsolved mystery, and Robin offers his own theories about what might have happened. Robin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And our second guest this week is Susan Simpson. Of course, she's one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast, as well as a co-host of the 45th podcast. She is also an attorney at the Volkov Law Group, and she blogs at viewfromll2.com.
Hey, Colin. And before we get started, just a quick note. You may have possibly heard me say last episode there was no addendum this week, but it turns out I can't read a calendar. So here we are, and my apologies.
So delving into this week's episode of Undisclosed, in episode 2 of The State versus Dennis Perry, we covered the two distinct phases of the investigation into the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain. That first phase ran from the Swain's murders in 1985 and ended in 1990 when all of the leads, including Dennis Perry, had been ruled out. And then the second phase started in 1998 with new lead investigator Deputy Dale Bundy and ended with Dennis Perry's conviction. So moving into, Robin, your involvement with the case, on July 4th, you did an episode of The Trail Went Cold that covered the Swain case. So first, can you tell us a little bit more about your podcast and then specifically what led you to report on the case?
Well, as you mentioned in the intro, The Trail Went Cold has been around for 2.5 years now. I decided to start it with my friend McGill Foote, who's a professional editor. I would write and host it, and he would edit it together and take care of the technical side. And we also had a composer friend of ours, a musician named Vince Nitro, who could provide our music score. So we're a very effective three-man team. I'm a huge fan of the TV series Unsolved Mysteries, so I like to cover a lot of cases from that show on the podcast, because a lot of the time the segments on the TV show did not tell the whole story. There was a lot more information that didn't get included on Unsolved Mysteries, so I wanted my episodes to offer the complete story as much as possible and also give me an opportunity to express my own theories about what happened. The Harold and Thelma Swain murders, aka the conviction of Dennis Perry, it was kind of different from the norm because technically the case has already been solved. If you watch the episode of Unsolved Mysteries on Amazon Prime, it just has this brief text update that says that a man named Dennis Perry, who had a grudge against Harold, was convicted of the murders and is now serving 2 life sentences. So you're under the assumption that is that. But once I delved further into the case and read this Denver Post article published in 2007, which shared some such information about how they had lost such key pieces of evidence, such as the glasses that Robert Stack held on the Unsolved Mysteries episode, and that Perry allegedly had an alibi, placing him hours away at the time the crime took place, and that DNA testing on one of the hairs did not match him, I started to think there was a lot more to this story, and I started to learn that there were a lot of people out there who felt that he had been wrongly convicted and that they did not get the right guy. And I eventually found the entire trial transcript for Perry's trial online at an old blog and decided I wanted to do an episode about it. And as I was recording it, I came to think, there's a really good chance that this guy didn't do it. And I last I had heard before that is that the Georgia Innocent Project had taken his case way back in 2015, but I hadn't heard anything since then. So I was wondered, is anyone actively still working on this? So it took me by complete surprise when only 1 week later, it was just a crazy coincidence, I found out that Undisclosed was devoting an entire season to this case. So that made me really happy. So it's just one of those weird ways the universe works, I guess, that we both released episodes at the exact same time.
Yeah, I didn't even see your episode until after we released episode 1 of the Dennis Perry series. Someone tweeted, it was like, did you plan this with The Trail Went Cold? I'm like, what are they talking about?
Yeah, me too. I found out about it on Twitter, in fact. And then when I made a tweet about it myself, and I saw that you guys and that John Cryer himself was retweeting it. I was like, wow, this is pretty exciting. And it's pretty cool that I wound up being a guest on your show.
Yeah, and Susan, you know, in terms of the typical cold case, this is almost the complete opposite, because as we noted and Robin noted in his episode, this is a case where the state gave him a take it or leave it deal. Essentially, we're going to have the possibility of the death penalty unless you sign away your appellate rights, and didn't give any time to consider it. And so eventually he signed that waiver. And so when you were talking to Claire at the Georgia Innocence Project about this case, did that waiver of his appellate rights give you any hesitation in the sense that there's not too much that can be done in the appeals process now?
It gave Claire hesitation. So I remember we were talking about it and, you know, going through all of, like, the wrinkles of the case and making sure that you know, like, what's in there, or, like, what would make it good for the podcast, what would make it bad for the podcast, what makes it a good case in general. And she, at the very end, she kind of brought it up. She's like, oh, there's one more thing I've got to tell you. And I think she was worried that we'd rule against it because of it. She's like, well, Dennis Perry can't actually appeal his case. But for us, I mean, the whole where I think Undisclosed works best and where has the most chance of being helpful or making an impact is on the cases where there are no other choices, no other chances left, where the people involved don't have any reasonable probability of getting relief through just pursuing legal methods and need public exposure of what happened to have any hope of getting traction in the system. So for us, I think that's not a benefit because it puts Dennis Perry in a very hard position. But for me, it was not a reason not to take the case.
And both of your responses tie into a Twitter question we have from Rob Arms. His Twitter handle is @RobArms. And he asked two questions. One, how could they let the glasses be handled that way on Unsolved Mysteries? And two, how can they get away with offering no death penalty in exchange for no appeal? And so, I mean, Susan, we covered this a bit in the episode, and Robin, you talked about it too. How do you think they were so lax in letting this evidence go to this television production and then essentially it being lost to the years?
I mean, the how is just someone fucked up. The question is who? According to some people at the sheriff's office down there, it was Joe Gregory who did it. And Joe Gregory says it was Bill Smith who did it. I am short of finding some emails that are some kind of communications now that prove who sent those glasses over. I don't know if the question can be answered. But yeah, someone done fucked up is the answer to the question.
And then for the second part of that question, you know, we have this and it's in the system where a defendant is allowed to essentially waive his right to appeal in exchange for the state taking the death penalty off the table. In terms of both your thoughts on that, does that give the state too much power or is that a fair bargaining chip?
Well, I had never heard of that before I looked into this case, and I thought it was pretty disturbing. I guess I could understand it maybe for a case where there was clear-cut evidence that the defendant was guilty and that this was the only way to avoid getting executed. But this case, the evidence just seemed so shaky. So I really could not believe it that after being convicted on such a weak case that he would be given an offer like this and told essentially that there's no chance you're ever going to get out of prison again, but you will avoid getting executed. And I can't imagine being an innocent person being offered a deal like that.
Yeah. As we mentioned earlier, it's kind of a, I don't want to use the word trend, but it's something of a trend now in plea cases to have a plea deal that also specifies there's no recourse later on. You can't appeal this. And I'm troubled by that. I think that's problematic. But I think when you have that sort of rider on an actual conviction that went to trial, I think the problems are magnified by 10. I mean, they don't go away just because it's a plea, but when you have a trial, you have someone who forced the state to put on evidence, and that evidence can now never be questioned. Yeah, no, it's currently under the law, it's allowed, but the obvious question is how far can it go? What if the state made up everything? What if the state fabricated evidence to get the conviction? What if the state rig the whole thing somehow? I'm not suggesting that happened here, but like theoretically, you could have a prosecutor that paid off the jury to convict a guy, and that could not be challenged.
Yeah, and Susan, to your point about these appellate waivers and plea agreements, in preparation for the episode, I looked, there's an article from the Duke Law Journal by Nancy King and Michael O'Neill. There was a study of 971 federal plea agreements in 2003. And the finding was that almost two-thirds of those contained some appellate waiver provision. That's not to say it waived all appellate rights, but at least some waiver of those rights, which tells you how popular these are in plea agreements. Susan, you mentioned in the episode that the family actually didn't want the death penalty. And how do you think that bears upon the prosecutor's decision here to use the death penalty as a bargaining chip when the family, who's of course most impacted by this, is saying, we don't want him to die for this crime?
Yeah, well, I don't, it's been many years, obviously, so the exact timing of how things went down is still for debate. But it does seem clear to me from talking to the family that they, for a lot of reasons, they don't believe in the death penalty. They did not want to see the killer, whoever he was, executed. To back up a bit, to do a trial, a murder trial, is really expensive in any case. But a capital trial is insanely expensive. I don't know the exact numbers, but like we're talking a lot of money here. So choosing to try Dennis Perry as a capital case would have increased the cost substantially, would have increased the time it took to do it, would have increased the odds of conviction due to death qualification of the jurors. So if they never actually intended to go through with it if they always knew the plan was if you get a conviction, they'd offer something else instead, that does seem coercive. I don't think you can make a constitutional claim out of it or anything like that. I just think it's inherently coercive, even if that's not a legally cognizable claim. I mean, the family doesn't have a right to say yes or no to death penalty. So it's not like the family can actually veto this one way or another. But it does, for me, makes it even more problematic if they never really intended to seek the death penalty. They just want to use that as leverage to get this kind of deal.
Here's what I love about Simply Safe. These guys obsess over the details. It's why the alarm system is so good. Here's an example. A typical glass break sensor sometimes gets fooled, a false positive. Sounds like dropped plates or a baby crying. Simply Safe didn't want to settle for typical, because really good home security should be really accurate. So they actually constructed a glass break test facility. They ran over 10,000 live glass break simulations, refining their detection technology until it was so accurate it can distinguish a broken plate from a broken window. This is the level of detail Simply Safe puts into everything they do. It sets them apart from other security companies. Simply Safe's system is designed so you'll never notice it, never have to think about it. It's that easy and intuitive. There's no contract. They work hard to earn your business. 24/7 monitoring with police and fire dispatch is just $15 a month. It's the best around-the-clock protection you can find. And now you can order your Simply Safe security system today at simplysafeundisclosed.com. And Simply Safe will also donate one to a family in need. That's simplysafeundisclosed.com. Simplysafeundisclosed.com. Yeah, and then a second point I wanted to address is, and I think this is for many people probably the heart of the matter, both in our podcast and Robin, your podcast, we covered this pair of prescription glasses recovering from the Rising Daughter and the possibility they belonged to the shooter, which of course would be very beneficial to Dennis Perry. He had 20/20 vision in both eyes, and these were thick prescription glasses. And so how convinced are both of you that these were the glasses belonging to the shooter as opposed to someone else's glasses that were left behind? Is this something where you're pretty much 100% convinced, or do you have some doubt about whether these were the shooter's glasses?
I have a little bit of doubt just because I saw the different descriptions from all the different witnesses, and it's pretty amazing that none of them can come up with a consensus on whether the shooter had glasses. And then I see that the witness, Vanzola Williams, how she was the one who came face to face with the killer, and she did not mention anything at first, if I recall, about the shooter having glasses until much later on. So I even start to wonder if these glasses actually belong to the killer, or if possibly somebody else could have left them there at a different point, and they have no relation to the killer at all. It's very strange. I guess it's also possible that the killer could have been carrying the glasses and wasn't actually wearing them, but still left them behind.
And Susan, how about you? Is this something where you're, after all your hours of investigation, pretty convinced this was the shooter's glasses, or do you have some doubt?
Like, there are very few things in general I'm 100% sure about. And there's a lot more to come in the glasses in particular. But in general, yes, I do think it is much more likely than not that the glasses are attached to someone involved in the killing. There are possible alternative explanations that we'll get into, which I don't find remotely convincing. And I mean, just the biggest mystery at this case, the start, when you look at it, is like, okay, well, where the hell did they come from? And if they are the killers, why can't you find the guy who did it, given all the information those glasses provide you with?
And here's a question that maybe one of you knows the answer to more than me, or maybe one of our listeners. I'm nearsighted, so I wear glasses all the time to see things in my everyday life. These were prescription glasses for a farsighted person, so someone who has difficulty seeing things close up. Do either of you know or have thoughts on whether a person who's farsighted and has a strong prescription would be wearing glasses sort of around for everyday life as opposed to just for reading?
I have one nearsighted eye and one farsighted eye, so I depend on glasses pretty much regardless. But I do think this guy would have needed them likely to just to function. Don't even think. I mean, the doctors who looked at it and the ophthalmologist who looked at these glasses, they said to the police multiple times, this person must have these glasses to function. If it was a younger guy, they possibly could have like struggled through for a bit without them, but this person would have been severely handicapped without them.
All right, so moving next to a third issue, Robin, you noted how much your podcast is inspired by Unsolved Mysteries, and of course, it is the origin of the coverage of the Swain case. And we noted in our episodes that the episode of Unsolved Mysteries got some details wrong, and now it looks to us like that might actually have been intentional. So we got a tweet from the Crime Junkie podcast saying, "We're loving Undisclosed Season 3, listening to the addendum now. Not sure if anyone else has brought this up, but Unsolved Mysteries used to change small facts intentionally to differentiate real tips from crazies who would just call in after seeing the show." So I've looked this up, and there are some online sites that seem to confirm this. It's unclear whether that's true or not, but regardless, we know in this case there were important facts that the episode got wrong. And so, you know, Susan, many of the people who testified in this case watched this episode. What effect do you think seeing this episode with some incorrect facts might have had in their testimony?
Well, I'll say initially, I'm very skeptical. Well, I'm not convinced that Unsolved Mysteries really did play false facts in their shows for that purpose. But the incorrect facts in this case, I don't think that's why they were included. And like I mentioned earlier, I think in the last addendum, it's not necessarily Unsolved Mysteries' fault that those facts were wrong. But in terms of how the show affects memory and affects the witnesses in the case, we'll get more into that later. It's also kind of hard to put together again this many years on what people remember from the show, what they recall from the actual events, because they've seen the show, they testified about it, they've lived these like the events themselves, and it all gets jumbled together. So it's hard for people to sort out in their memories 33 years on which memories come from real life and which come from the show.
Yeah, and there's a rule of evidence, Rule 615, that allows for the sequestration of witnesses, and it's for exactly that purpose, Susan, you're touching on, which is we don't want a witness tainted by prior testimony. We want them to remember what they remember and not be influenced by others. And so, yeah, there's definitely a concern here that could have happened. And Robin, obviously, in your podcast, you're primarily covering these cold cases that are unsolved and that one day could go to trial. Do you ever think about the effect that might have if someone who would be a witness at a later trial listens to your podcast before testifying?
Well, believe it or not, I wondered if this actual situation was going to happen sometime last year, because last January I did an episode about a missing woman named Pamela Butler who vanished from her home in 2009 and had never been found. And only 3 months after the episode came out, her former boyfriend, Jose Rodriguez Cruz, was finally charged with her murder. And even though they never found her body, apparently witnesses had recently come forward with new information that was strong enough evidence for them to make an arrest. And in the end, he did not actually go to trial. He took a plea deal. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking, what if some of these witnesses who came forward had listened to my podcast? Like, what happens if this goes to trial and anyone who listened to it might appear on the stand? We'll probably never know, because since he took a plea deal, they did not publicly release what new evidence came about that compelled them to arrest him after all these years. But I do think it's an interesting topic to ponder, because in recent months, there have been a lot of cold cases that are being solved, and a lot of these cases have been covered on true crime podcasts. So I have to wonder, when some of these cases eventually go to trial, if there will be people who heard those podcasts beforehand and it may influence their testimony.
So how many cases have you covered that have ultimately gotten solved that you know of?
That's the only one that I know of that's been solved.
Yeah, and Susan, in terms of our coverage of the Swain case this season, in one way, it's very similar to the Joy Watkins case in that both of the men were initially ruled out as suspects before eventually then they were prosecuted. But as we noted in this episode, while the Joy Watkins case was very much, it seemed, a personal prosecution, in this case, as you said, it wasn't really personal, but it was very much a political prosecution, politically based. In your mind, in looking at these two cases, do you think one or more was equally dangerous, personal versus political, or that the sort of both have equal risks?
Man, I don't know if that's a question I could mathematically sort of separate and weigh against one another. I mean, anytime there are external influences, and there's always external influences, you risk the decision-making process being influenced adversely. But at the same time, there's no even conceivable way, like you couldn't take out those concerns. In a small town, there's going to be personal knowledge of the defendants and suspects. That's going to affect how cops operate. And small or big towns, the politics are always a factor. So it's more a question of how to minimize those effects rather than trying to remove them entirely. But yeah, both can be dangerous if an agency is not effectively keeping them in check and looking at its own motivations for certain actions.
Yeah, and Robin, in terms of politically based prosecutions and sometimes prosecutors holding on to beliefs for years, we noted that your podcast typically covers unsolved cold cases, but I listened this morning to one of your episodes, which actually covered a wrongful conviction case, which I found to be especially interesting given some of the topics we've covered recently. And that was the Juan Rivera case. Can you tell us a bit about the details of that case?
Well, this is one of the worst wrongful conviction cases I've ever encountered. The actual crime involved the murder of an 11-year-old girl named Holly Staker in Waukegan, Illinois in 1992, and she was raped and stabbed 27 times. And later on, they found a suspect named Juan Rivera, and they interrogated him for about 4 days without an attorney present, and it got to the point where he suffered a psychotic breakdown and was banging his head against the wall. But he eventually confessed to the crime. They charged him with the murder, but the problem is that there was really no other evidence to prove that he did it. They later found out that since he was on parole for a unrelated burglary, he was wearing an ankle monitoring device at the time, and the electronic record showed that he was at home at the night of the murder, but the prosecution tried to cover that up by saying, well, it must have malfunctioned or he slipped out of it and slipped out to commit the murder. And then they were about to introduce some shoes he had worn into evidence at trial, which apparently had the victim's blood on it. But fortunately, the defense found evidence that he did not actually purchase these shoes until months after the murder took place. And the shoes were not even available in stores at that time because they were sitting in a distribution warehouse on the exact night the murder took place. So it seemed obvious that someone had planted the victim's blood on his shoes in an attempt to secure a conviction. But Rivera was found guilty at his first trial. The conviction got overturned. He was found guilty again at a second trial. And then finally, they did DNA testing on some semen found at the murder scene, and it did not match Rivera. So you would think that they would not try to take him on trial again, but they actually did take him to trial a third time, and they tried to explain away the DNA evidence by saying that the victim, Holly Staker, had consensual sex with another man before she was murdered, and that's who the semen belonged to, and that Rivera killed her afterwards. But the problem was Holly Staker was 11 years old, so the way they had to make their case in court is act like this 11-year-old girl was sexually active, and that became the focus, trying to convince the jury that this girl was sexually active rather than trying to convince them that Juan Rivera killed her. But it actually worked, and he was found guilty again, but his conviction was overturned a third time, and this time the appellate court finally said that you cannot try this guy again for this crime. This is over. This is ridiculous. And in a final twist to that case, they actually found the DNA that matched the semen sample on another murder, right, which took place in the year 2000 involving a man named Delwin Foxworth, which meant that the same person who killed Holly Staker also committed a second murder while Juan Rivera was incarcerated. So, and it's technically still an unsolved cold case because they still have not identified this person who has murdered at least two people. And it doesn't look like they want to, because the whole Juan Rivera wrongful conviction is just kind of a huge embarrassment for the state, just because they wanted to keep this guy locked up and they were willing to do anything to not admit they were wrong.
Yeah, and eventually that was a settlement, and it was for $20 million in 2015. And yeah, it's insane to me that after that DNA evidence came back, their claim was this 11-year-old had consensual sex, and that's how someone else's DNA ended up at the crime scene. that ties in because we're looking at that case. That might be a cold case that eventually hits another suspect and that person's prosecuted. And I wanted to touch upon this subject because this is interesting how it relates to the Dennis Perry case, and that is statutes of limitations. So in Georgia, for instance, let's say there's an arson or a burglary. They have a 4-year statute of limitations, which means that crime has to be prosecuted within 4 years after commission. Well, the classic line is that there's no statute of limitations for murder. And of course, you know, on the one hand, we completely understand that murder is the most heinous crime, and we don't want people to elude justice just because the crime wasn't solved for years. On the other hand, Susan, as you note in the episode, this is a case where Dennis Perry was initially cleared as a suspect due to his work alibi. And then understandably, when it's 18 years later and he's trying to prove that alibi, his employer is no longer in existence and it's really tough to prove that alibi or defend himself. And so, I mean, I have mixed feelings. You know, Susan and Robin, what are your thoughts on the lack of a statute of limitations for murder? Good thing, bad thing? Are there ways in a case like the Dennis Perry case where someone's been ruled out where we can sort of maybe put a statute of limitations in there?
I'm not opposed to the lack of a statute of limitations. And I think it reflects in part that for murder, well, for other crimes, if someone had been caught and done their time, it would have been over years ago. And part of the equation there is why disrupt someone's life and send them to prison 25 years later on for, you know, a 2-year sentence that they could have served and gotten out and restarted their life again. For murder, it's conceivably a life sentence or worse, and no matter when they're caught, the sentence they'd still be in the same place once they're in prison. It's part of the logic. At the same time, there are a few high-profile cases that were cold cases that were solved and seemed to have gotten the wrong answer, and owing to inherent limitations after that much time has passed, well, it's hard for the prosecutors, but it's hard for the defense too, and I would love to see a study on the outcomes in those kind of cases. If convictions are less likely, more likely, wrongful convictions more likely or less likely. And at the very least, any jurisdiction that plans to bring and prosecute a cold case better have kept a good handle of its evidence in that time, which was not the case here.
And do you think that there could be something such as in this case, or we mentioned something similar in the Joy Watkins case, obviously that wasn't a cold case for nearly as long, but where essentially if we have a department that has identified someone as a suspect and then they officially rule them out, that sort of triggers some sort of protection for them, that they won't be prosecuted years later? Or would that be too difficult because, you know, who knows, maybe DNA evidence comes back later and links them to the crime?
I mean, theoretically, our current system of evidence should be able to handle that. Theoretically, you should be able to have other people involved in the case testify and explain what happened. And that did happen here. But the jury didn't believe it. I don't know if there's a better way of doing it, but I you'd know better as the evidence professor. But my sense is that like this is kind of a situation our system was already designed to handle. It's just not handling great all the time.
Yeah, and Robin, do you have any thoughts as someone who, of course, does a podcast primarily on cold cases? Do you think that there, either for murder or for other serious crimes, should be a statute of limitations?
Well, I generally don't think there should be a statute of limitations for murder. And I think the last several months has kind of proved this because there's been a plethora of cold cases that are several decades old where they're now finally making arrests, though it's stuff like the Golden State Killer. But in those cases, there's clear-cut DNA evidence. So I'm definitely for arresting people after all this time. But I guess it does kind of get iffy with a case like Dennis Perry, where he's arrested like several years after the fact, but it turns out that a lot of the evidence from the case has gone missing and they have to convict him on some pretty shaky evidence that they have left. And I mean, I don't know if I would be willing to get rid of a statute of limitations for situations just like that, but I think compromises could be made in extreme circumstances like this.
So we have a couple of Twitter questions related to this topic. The first is from Tim Arnold. His Twitter handle is @TimKArnold. And he asks, did Dennis frequently work for the Atlanta company? Could the IRS have W-2 details that help back up Dennis's alibi? So Susan, any information on that front?
No, they wouldn't have like hours work. I mean, they have his pay stub. There's no way to, you know, reverse engineer that and figure out where he was on a certain day.
Yeah, so, I mean, just sort of annual salary, we really have no way of knowing that particular day.
Yeah, and in 98, they tried really hard to find it. And I mean, it was from the company side, it just wasn't there anymore. I don't think there is a possibility of obtaining it.
And our next Twitter question is from BazinGram8, Twitter handle at Drops of Blood, and he asks, can the deputy who initially cleared Dennis Perry testify or file an affidavit indicating that he confirmed Dennis was at work all day on the day of the crime and could not have made it into the church on time?
Oh, he testified at the trial. That all came in. The jury just didn't believe it. Which, you know, is the jury's, that is their job to decide whether to believe or not believe evidence before them. And they had some officers saying that there was no alibi, or they never saw an alibi, and some officers saying that he had one and it was checked out. So the question really came down to why the evidence was missing. If you believed it was missing because of just age and accident, then maybe there's not really an inference that weighs against the prosecution. On the other hand, if you don't believe the explanation that it was just accident, that is why the evidence went missing, that would weigh the other way. In this case, the jury just thought that, you know, there was some incompetent, you know, people involved, evidence got lost, it happens, but it doesn't change the fact that there never was documentation that showed this alibi existed. On the other hand, the state actually can't bring anyone forward to testify that such documents didn't exist because no one can, like, confirm a negative that way. No one can be like, I read the whole case file 10 years ago and I can confirm every single piece of paper in there. So really, the jury was just given the option of most likely he's guilty and most likely no evidence of alibi ever existed. And the testimony of the officers who said it did exist, but, you know, it's an old case. Maybe they just forgot too.
And of course, as we covered on the Willie Vesey series, even in a case where someone has their time card from their job, that might not be enough of an alibi. And so, yeah, you never know what could happen. But yeah, obviously, this case being prosecuted 18 years later presented some complications. I wanted to drop some news that just occurred in the past week, and that is from our first season case, the Adnan Syed case. You might have heard the news that the Court of Appeals of Maryland, Maryland State Supreme Court, granted cert or agreed to hear the appeal in the Adnan Syed case. That means that they're going to hear both the alibi claim by the state, who is claiming that was wrongfully decided in favor of Adnan, as well as the cell tower claim, which the defense is going to claim is wrongfully decided in favor of the state. That will be briefed over the next few months, court documents to the court. And then either the end of November or beginning of December, we're going to have oral arguments in the Court of Appeals of Maryland. That will be live streamed on their website, so you'll be able to watch those online. Susan, what are your thoughts on the grant cert in this case?
You know, it's terrible because of the time it's going to take to resolve all this. And it's just another year, more likely a year and a half, before we have any resolution and before Adnan could potentially go free. But I'll admit my first reaction seeing the news was more relief than disappointment. It sucks for Adnan. It all sucks for Adnan. But at the same time, I appreciate the chance to get another shot at the waiver issue with regards to the cell tower evidence, which for Adnan, it doesn't matter. He just needs to win on one claim. So if he wins on the Asia claim and does not win on the other, it's the same outcome. But going forward, future cases, that ruling on the waiver issue would bar innocence claims from a lot of defendants. And I don't think it was rightly decided and would like to see the highest court in Maryland reevaluate it.
And Robin, of course, the Adnan Syed case was first covered on Serial. And from your timeline, you started your podcast about 2.5 years ago. Did you listen to Serial? Was that an inspiration at all for your podcast?
Oh, yes, definitely. It was pretty much my introduction into true crime podcasting in general. And I think if you ask most people who started their own true crime podcast within the last couple of years, they'll name Serial as their number one inspiration because the whole genre has really taken off. I even appeared on Podcast Row at CrimeCon in Nashville way back in May, and I briefly met Rabia because I know Undisclosed was represented as well. So it's just, I think we can trace that all back to Serial because it's the one that jump-started the whole thing.
And that ties into one of our Twitter questions. It comes from Nikki Wells. Her Twitter handle is @DancerNL, or number one. And she asks, the Unsolved Mysteries theme song and Robert Stack's voice brought back many memories watching hours of that show on TV during my childhood summers. Do you consider that show the start of the wave of true crime media in the 90s? And so, Robin and Susan, what are your thoughts? Was this sort of the ground zero of true crime media. As far as I can tell, when I was growing up in the 80s, that's the first thing I remember covering true crime. Do either of you have thoughts about how important that was in this whole wave we're seeing sort of renewed now?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It was one of my favorite shows as a kid. I think I would consider that and America's Most Wanted to be the ones that jump-started it, because they both started around the same time. But I think back to what a different era it was in the 80s, where they would put a case on there, but because there was no internet, the only way you could ever find out that case would be solved would be to watch the later episodes and get an update on their crimes. And it was amazing to see how so many of them were solved because people called their telecenter to provide information. And back then, that was often the only way that they could help solve a lot of these cases and give them the exposure they needed.
Yeah. I think by the time I saw it, it was already well into reruns. And what I remember about the cases is that the first ones I remember seeing, by the time I was watching them, they were already so old. And they don't really clarify a lot of the timelines in those episodes, too. So you'd be watching a show about, you know, a murder that happened and not realize or not put together that actually it's 30 years old at that point. And that comes back in this case as well, because this episode has been playing for a long time. So there are people who've called in with suspects for this murder who were, you know, like 5 years old at the time it happened. And for those who want to see the episode, like we mentioned before, it's on Amazon Prime, if you have that. And also, apparently, according to my mom anyway, it's coming up on TV and cable next month, or the end of the month. So check your listings.
Our next question comes from Thomas Ahern. His Twitter handle is @MistExplorer, and he asks, do the Swains have any surviving relatives? So Susan, do you know, have you talked to them? Have they had any reactions so far to the podcast?
Well, their niece, Cynthia Clayton, you've heard on the show. She's the only one who was willing to be recorded. But they do have some relatives still around. But in terms of close relatives, I'd say Cynthia's mother, who was essentially Thelma Swain's sister, is the closest relative that's still living, still in Waverly.
And Robin, in terms of your podcast, how often do you hear from family members or talk to family members in these cold cases?
Sometimes I do hear from them. Sometimes I've been in touch with them beforehand, but sometimes the cold cases are so obscure that there's no way to really contact them. But the feedback I've gotten has generally been positive. There's one case in particular where the relative of the victim pretty much gave me the whole scenario about what they think happened and who committed the murder. But the only problem is they lack the evidence to make an arrest, but they hope the fact that it was featured on the podcast might compel somebody to come forward after all these years and potentially lead to closure in these cases. So it's been a pretty good experience so far.
Right. Our last Twitter question comes from Todd Shaw. His Twitter handle is @tshaw07, and this relates to something we discussed in the last addendum. He writes, I was listening to the addendum and I had a comment about judge bias. To me, the biggest problem with judges are they are usually former prosecutors, so of course they have bias toward the defense. So I looked this up, and a couple data points. One, there hasn't been a former criminal defense attorney on the Supreme Court since Thurgood Marshall retired in 1993. And there's data from a 2015 study that showed that during President Obama's tenure, just 14% of nominees had public defense experience, while 41% of judicial nominees, this is the federal level, had experience working as prosecutors. Susan and Robin, any thoughts about the general disparity between former prosecutors as judges versus former defense attorneys?
I don't know. I'm not really an expert on this, but I could see how it could be troublesome. Just the possibility of getting biased judges who side with the prosecution during trials because that's what they worked in. But I mean, hopefully it doesn't lead to any problems, but I could see how it could.
Yeah, I think it goes to a bigger problem of systematic issue and systematic diversity and the lack thereof. There are definitely no guarantees that a former prosecutor will be a very anti-defendant judge or that a former defense attorney will be a very pro-defendant judge. But at the same time, our judicial class has been overwhelmingly ex-prosecutors, older white men. And I think there is a lot of value in having a diverse bench in all respects, and especially in terms of occupations. And I think there could be value. I mean, most of judges' work is not even criminal in nature. So I think that drawing from both the criminal bar, the civil bar, just basically expanding in general where you pull judges from would be beneficial. even the schools they come from. Look at our Supreme Court. Basically, it's Yale or Harvard. I think that's probably hugely damaging to our system today when you have the entire Supreme Court basically drawn from one of two schools. That can lead to a very rigid sort of pool to draw from. I mean, yeah. I have no stats to back this up, but I think that is a problem in our current court that's certainly not being addressed today.
Well, that covers us for episode 2 addendum of the Dennis Perry case. Susan, anything for listeners to look forward to in episode 3?
Well, we'll get more into the case against Dennis Perry and what evidence there actually was and was not. But for those who listened to our series last year on Gary Mitchum Reeves, a brief update. Lana and Mitchum actually met for the first time in Cartersville over the weekend. They never knew each other. It's two of the people involved in that series. So I won't spoil anything, but if you listen to that, go check out the Twitter and see pictures. And also, in the next few months, I think you can expect a podcast from Mitchum to be coming out. So we'll give more details when those are available.
All right, great. Well, thanks for joining me today, Susan, and thanks for joining me today, Robin. His podcast is The Trail Went Cold. His Twitter handle is @Robin_Warder. Robin, any episodes upcoming on The Trail Went Cold for listeners to look forward to?
Well, next week I'm going to be releasing one about the death of Jonathan Luna, who is a federal prosecutor from Baltimore who went missing late one night from his courthouse and was found in a creek in Pennsylvania, stabbed 36 times with his own penknife.
Okay, well, listeners, thanks for tuning in to this week's addendum. We'll see you back next Monday with episode 3 of the Dennis Perry series. Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed Addendum. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Mital Telhan, our executive producer, Simply Safe, our sponsor for this episode, and the Georgia Innocence Project, a terrific organization that could use your assistance. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod.